You ever wonder how we can treat substance use disorder specifically in psychotic patients? Not surprisingly, the reward and motivation centers in the brain are affected by disorders like schizophrenia. And my guest today, Lauren Peters, has studied this phenomenon during her graduate training at Eastern Tennessee State University. First of all, East Tennessee State University. Welcome to the Journal Club, Lauren.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for agreeing to do this with me.
Of course.
And by the way, just for listeners, she was wearing East Tennessee State University jersey here in the studio. So she's truly representing. Paper came out less than a month ago, and it was actually shared on our lab Slack. And it came out in the Journal of Psychopharmacology, and the title is Effects of Positive MGLU5 Modulation on D2 Signaling and Nicotine Conditioned Place Preference, Mechanisms of Epigenetic Inheritance in a Transgenerational Model of Drug Abuse Vulnerability. That's a mouthful.
It is, yeah. There's a lot going on in the paper.
Okay. Did you come up with the title?
It was a collaborative effort between my previous PI and I. He has very descriptive titles, and this is just what happened.
All right. So, Lauren, let's start with the objective of this study. Why should we study substance use disorder in psychosis?
So, psychosis is highly comorbid with substance use disorder, particularly with nicotine. So, about 75% of people with schizophrenia smoke cigarettes compared to the general population, which is about 20%. The biggest problem with that comorbidity is that comorbid nicotine use can actually impact the way that those antipsychotic medications, the efficacy of those antipsychotic medications. So if they're comorbid with smoking, those antipsychotic medications are less effective. It actually affects the metabolism of those drugs in your blood. So you're required to take higher and higher doses of the antipsychotic medication in order to reach clinically effective levels.
Mm-hmm.
And given the high levels of extrapyramidal side effects that come with antipsychotics, that's particularly problematic.
Okay. Well, I did not know that, but today I do.
Happy to help.
And by the way, when Lauren agreed to do this episode with me, I asked her to pick her best graduate work, and you picked this paper. But you also said that it's not very technical. And I have to disagree with you on that one. I think the technique of using transgenerational models to study psychosis disorders, and also at the same time epigenetics, is really interesting to me. And I really like the epigenetic approach. Why is epigenetics, in your opinion, a more interesting approach to study psychosis and also other psychiatric disorders?
So first, I guess the reason I describe it as less technical is because they're a lot less, they're older techniques that are not as complex. Like, they're more simple techniques, which sometimes is what you need to do to answer the questions that you have. But it's just, if you're talking about, it's not as exciting as, optogenetics and things like that, is all I meant by that. But in terms of why epigenetics is more exciting and more relevant for neuropsychiatric disorders is because, particularly with schizophrenia, there is a genetic component. It's about 40 to 50% concordance rate among monozygotic twins. So we know it's genetic, but we know it's not just genetic. There's not been any single gene or single set of genes that's been indicated in schizophrenia. It's suggested to be more combination of genetic, epigenetic, environmental factors that kind of converge to create the symptom cluster that we call schizophrenia or psychosis.
Okay. Just for listeners who might not have a science background, how do you define epigenetics?
So it's sort of a way for your, a marker of molecular memory in your genes. So epigenetics, it's not, if you're talking about genetic changes, it's something that's happened to your gene that is altered, it's a mutation, something like that, that's altered the way that your gene, exists. Whereas epigenetics is more the way that it's being expressed. So that gene exists, and then it can be turned on or turned off depending on epigenetic mechanisms. So it's not altering the way that your structure of your DNA, it's just altering the way that you were expressing those genes.
Okay. All right. Now let's set up the model that you use to study this. So you have rats, and these rats were given Quinperol. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Quinperol, yeah.
Quinperol, okay. So this drug, Quinpro, is a dopamine receptor agonist. Mm-hmm. It binds to the receptors of dopamine, and we expect it to increase the sensitivity of those brain regions to dopamine further during adulthood in these rats.
Yeah. So the important part is that we're injecting these rats from postnatal day 1 to postnatal day 21, so the first 3 weeks of development. So if you were talking about adult rats, if you were administering an agonist, you'd expect it to have the opposite result, is that it wouldn't supersensitize those receptors. Those receptors would desensitize. That's what happens with cocaine addiction and things like that. But because this is happening during development, these animals' brains develop around the circumstance. So instead of adapting as it would as an adult, it's developing with this in mind. So that's why it's creating that supersensitivity.
Okay. And then you take the offspring from these Quinpro-treated rats and use them in the study.
Yes. So the model is, we administer this D2 receptor agonist Quinpro to neonatal rats from postnatal day 1 to 21. We then raise them up to postnatal day 60 and mate them with another Quinpro-treated animal. Mm-hmm. And that creates this F1 or second generation. So these animals aren't treated with anything. They grow up. And we test the behaviorally, phenotypically, do they show the same phenotypes that are consistent with psychosis, consistent with what we call drug abuse vulnerability? And is it to the same degree in these F1 generation offspring as it was in their F0 generation parents in adulthood? So we see this long-lasting increase in this D2 supersensitivity, which is actually the most consistent biomarker that we see in both preclinical animal models and in clinical population.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, why did you specifically choose the D2 receptors and not other types of dopamine receptors? Is it something that we understand in the research of schizophrenia?
Yeah, so it's what we were interested in studying with this model is something called shared neural substrates.
Okay.
So we're looking at what is a point of convergence of both psychosis and drug abuse, which could be conferring this increased risk of nicotine abuse in this population. So is there something molecularly that is in common between these two different disorders, which is causing this increased vulnerability? Mm-hmm. And that's, for us, the D2 receptor, is that it's implicated in schizophrenia. It's all clinically used antipsychotic medication converges on D2 receptor antagonism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the point of convergence for drugs of abuse. They all act on that D2 receptor.
Okay. Has Quinpro been used in humans before, or any of its analogs perhaps?
Not in humans specifically with Quinpro, but it is just a general D2 agonist.
Okay.
So like all drugs of abuse, they all have different mechanisms of action, but they all have that D2 receptor activity where they are agonizing that D2 receptor.
Okay. And you described it earlier, but I wanted to reiterate this to the audience. The way we study psychiatric conditions has changed over the years. Instead of focusing on the disease in and of itself, for example, schizophrenia, we try to study a specific phenotype of schizophrenia and try to describe it molecularly and at the circular level in the brain. And so this approach of trying to study the phenotype that a disease manifests is the current approach to studying mental disorders. And at the same time, we see this interesting cross phenotype that we observe. In this case, it's going to be schizophrenia and substance use disorder. So we target one phenotype, and during that endeavor, we learn a lot about different psychiatric conditions. And so you set your study up, you injected the parents with Quinpro and then studied the offspring. And the first thing that you looked at is behavior, and specifically nicotine condition place preference.
Yeah. So in this paper, what we were interested in is looking at the rewarding associative effects of nicotine. So we do that by studying condition place preference.
Mm-hmm.
It's a classical conditioning paradigm, if you're in the psychology world at all. It's done by pairing a particular context in a box or an apparatus with a rewarding drug, in our case, nicotine. So what we've found in the past in both our F0 generation animals and in their offspring is that there is this increased condition place preference.
Mm-hmm.
So after that animal has been paired with nicotine in that particular context. We look at, will they seek out that context in the future? And we see that animals who have been treated with Quimperol or their offspring spend significantly more time in that paired context. So they have an increased, what we're describing that as, is they have an increased propensity to seek out that context, which is an increased rewarding associative aspect. So what we find is that animals that have been neonatally treated with Quimperol or their offspring show this increased condition place preference. So they're spending more time in that context that was paired with nicotine than saline-treated control animals that are given nicotine.
Okay.
So we describe that as an increased response to D2 agonists, which is, for us, phenotypically demonstrating that there's an increase in D2 supersensitivity.
Got it. Okay. And in for those of you following with the paper in hand, this is placed in figure 2 of the paper. And in that figure, you also used a positive allosteric modulator for mGlu5, which is the metabotropic glutamate receptor, right? So could you describe to us why the mGlu5 is important in this whole context? Because I always struggle to describe receptors, agonists, antagonists in very simple terms so that people who do not have a science background can understand them. Maybe you do have a better approach of doing this. So I really want to hear it from you.
We'll see. Well, I guess, first of all, the reason that we were using this drug in the first place. So our research had two primary goals. So my dissertation focused on, one, validating this model that we created, and then two, looking at, can we use the model to identify different treatment targets that may be more effective than antipsychotic medications and that also may have fewer side effects? So we chose the mGlu5 receptor as a target because the metabotropic glutamate receptor type 5, it forms a heteroreceptor complex with dopamine D2 and another receptor called the adenosine A2A receptor. So what that means is that these three receptors, you know, they form a complex together, in that if you stimulate one of these receptors within this complex, it impacts the way that these other receptors function.
Okay.
So if you stimulate the mGlu5 receptor, it actually reduces the affinity of the D2 receptor to bind to dopamine. And like I mentioned before, antipsychotic medications, they have that D2 antagonistic effect, which means that they block the D2 receptor so that D2 signaling can't occur. And that's actually what a lot of the side effects that stem from antipsychotic medications come from, is blocking that D2 receptor specifically, because a lot of things that you need, like movement and things, are dependent on that D2 receptor. So you get movement side effects that are very disturbing to patients, and they there's a lot of treatment noncompliance. They stop taking it.
Okay.
So the idea is, if we can find a target to treat which can reduce that dopamine signaling, which we know is a problem, but not to such a degree that it's completely blocking it and causing these side effects, that it might be more effective and patients might keep taking it. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea behind using that mGlu5 drug, is that we can modulate that D2 system without causing those side effects. So what a positive allosteric modulator does, as opposed to, so we have antagonists which block the receptor, then we have agonists which stimulate the receptor to sort of activate that signaling pathway that stems from activating that receptor. A positive allosteric modulator, it binds to a spot that isn't the normal binding pocket. So you can think of a normal binding pocket as a key and lock mechanism, right? So you have the dopamine D2 receptor, which is your lock, and then the dopamine molecule is your key. So a positive allosteric modulator will bind somewhere that isn't that lock, but it will change the shape of the lock. So for us, that means that it's changing it in such a way that it's increasing the likelihood that glutamate will bind and have effects. So I hope that kind of describes what a positive allosteric modulator is in a way that's not too jargony.
Oh, no, that was great. Okay. I mean, especially when you brought up the lock and key model, I knew you were going to do a great job of describing receptor and agonist-antagonist relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how it was described to me, and I took a couple of psychopharmacology classes, and they always use that analogy, and I find it super helpful because it's a way for you to visualize what's happening in a way that you can connect to on a universal level.
Okay. And what makes this more complex is there isn't just one key in this particular context. There's three keys that work together, right? There's the adenosine receptor, the A2A receptor, There's the D2 dopamine 2 receptor, and then there's the metabotropic glutamate receptor 5. And they all act in unison to drive this pathway. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah. So the mGlu5 and the A2A receptor can have a synergistic action.
Okay.
So if you stimulate either mGlu5 or A2A, you have the same effect on dopamine signaling.
Okay.
So both of those receptors, by stimulating them, you reduce dopamine signaling. And actually, other work that's published out of the lab has used an agonist for the A2A receptor, just looking at how do we target that heteroreceptor in a different way.
Okay.
But yeah, so it's sort of those two receptors can modulate the way that dopamine signaling is occurring. So it's just another way for your system to sort of, like, if dopamine signaling is getting out of control, it's just another way for your system to sort of tamp down on that and keep, it's like a homeostatic mechanism. It keeps stuff flowing the way that it's supposed to be.
Great. And then after doing this behavioral paradigm, you take it to a more molecular level. You look at the expression of two proteins. One is RGS9 and the other is beta-arrestin. Two questions for you here.
Mm-hmm.
Why those two proteins? And two, if you're looking at the paper for the, I'm talking to the audience now. If you're looking at the paper, you see that three brain regions, the nucleus accumbens shell, the prelimbic cortex, the infralimbic cortex are used in this proteomic analysis. And we both, currently, both Lauren and I work in a nucleus accumbens heavy lab. So I understand the role of the nucleus accumbens in reward related behaviors. And of course, as a location for the D2 the neurons that contain the D2 receptors. But why look at the prelimbic cortex and the infralimbic cortex?
So I guess I'll answer the brain region question first.
Okay.
So the dopamine system, yeah, primarily when we're studying drug addiction, we do focus on the nucleus accumbens as this sort of hub of reward-dependent activity. So it's kind of what modulates the behavioral output of rewarding aspects of drugs. But there's also inputs, dopaminergic inputs, that go to your prefrontal cortex.
Mm-hmm.
And then that prefrontal cortex will also project down to your nucleus accumbens. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of these different converging signals that help to kind of regulate the way that nucleus accumbens is responding to different environmental stimuli.
Okay.
So in the paper we did, the infralimbic cortex and the prelimbic cortex, which are subregions of the medial prefrontal cortex, they receive a lot of dopaminergic signaling, and then they also project to the nucleus accumbens. So we were interested in sort of not just the nucleus accumbens, which we know is a converging spot for both psychosis and for drug abuse, but are these other brain regions being affected in a way that might, again, that homeostatic question is, are there adaptations that are happening in different brain regions in our model? And can we target them with different drugs to help kind of have this more brain-wide effect on different symptom profiles?
Mm-hmm.
So the psychosis itself is generally understood to be driven by nucleus accumbens and these D2 receptors. But there are also other symptom profiles of psychosis, or of schizophrenia, rather. Mm-hmm. So you have cognitive symptoms as well as negative symptoms, which is more, it affects your memory, your learning, and things like that. So those are not necessarily driven by your nucleus accumbens. So this is a more, can we affect symptom profiles that aren't just that psychosis?
Okay. And I would like to remind you the first question, which was, why look at the two proteins?
Thank you. So RGS9, it's regulator of G protein signaling 9.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a member of a family of proteins that, as the name suggests, regulate G protein signaling.
Okay.
So the D2 receptor is a G protein coupled receptor, meaning that a lot of its signaling pathways that are triggered in response to dopamine binding are mediated by this G protein that kind of comes and goes off of the receptor. So RGS9 is specific for D2, and it impacts the way that G protein can dissociate from the receptor. So an increase in RGS9, it leads to dissociation of that G protein, so there's reduced signaling. So we use that as a marker of what's called G protein dependent signaling. So what we look at is, are there changes in the expression of that protein, how much of that protein is around in our model, and also is that protein expression affected by our mGlu5 positive allosteric modulator? What we find is a reduction in RGS9 in the nucleus accumbens, and this specific paper, it's the shell of the nucleus accumbens we were looking at, as well as the prelimbic and the infralimbic cortex. So what that means is RGS9, if there's reduction in RGS9, there's reduced association of that G protein. So there is an increase in that G protein signaling pathway. And then sort of less canonically, there is also G protein independent signaling. So you can think of it as early phase and late phase signaling. So the early phase, what's happening immediately when dopamine binds to that receptor, is this G protein pathway. And then more of this late phase activity, you have G protein independent signaling. So beta arrestin 2 is a marker that we use for that G protein independent signaling that is specific to the D2 receptor.
Okay. All right. And just to clarify, when you're applying this positive allosteric modulator CDPPB, does it decrease the expression of these two proteins in the rats?
So we found a very dose-dependent and region-dependent effects with that.
Okay.
So when we were administering sort of a higher dose of CDPPB, which is our positive allosteric modulator, in the nucleus accumbens, we found that it was able to normalize that signaling. So for RGS9, it was able to increase that protein back to what was control levels.
Mm-hmm.
And then for beta arrestin 2, which is typically what we find is increased in our model, high and low doses of that were able to reduce beta arrestin 2 back to control levels in the nucleus accumbens. We found it was kind of more complex results in the cortex. So in the prelimbic cortex, we didn't find any effects of the drug. Neither dose was effective. In the infralimbic cortex, for our G protein independent signaling, there wasn't any effect, but we did see that high dose of CDPPB was able to normalize that G protein dependent signaling in the infralimbic cortex. So what that says to us is that much like the disorder, we're finding is a lot of complex regulation of that system, of the dopamine system, and that it's being regulated in different ways in different brain regions, depending on, you know, we can modulate with different drugs and it's having a different effect depending on the region that you're interested in.
God. All right. And the last part of your study goes back to what we were talking about, the epigenetics. And I am the kind of person who is not good with like high throughput data analysis and also just looking at data from, for example, RNA-seq or like enrichment kind of assays and looking at, okay, this specific gene and this specific pathway has been enriched after such an exposure. And that's what your paper goes into. So what kinds of epigenetic enrichment did you see in these offspring of quinaprole treated rats?
So what we did in this paper was a follow-up to work that we had done previously. So a paper that was published by Dr. Drew Gill now, who graduated from the lab that I was in the year after I started. He, in his dissertation, did some work with RNA sequencing,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a general measure of is there differential expression of genes.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily give you mechanistic answers. It just tells you that there is something different about those, the way that those genes are being expressed.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can use this really sophisticated software to it takes those genes that are differentially expressed and it groups them into pathways that they are associated with.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the best way to kind of explain that is, you know, one gene isn't going to accomplish one big job. It takes several genes that are coming together to have different effects that are increasing a specific pathway, which is going to have biological impact.
Got it.
So what this software does is it takes all of those genes. So you have, you know, genes that are associated with neurite outgrowth. So like the way that your neurons are growing and adapting, as well as like, you know, signaling pathways that are related to your dopamine receptor and things like that. And it's grouping them together so that you can see not just this one specific gene is affected, but the whole pathway that that gene is part of is affected. So it gives you more of a biological readout. So you can see it's not just, you know, this gene, you know, if one gene is affected, it may not actually have an impact on your whole body because it might be homeostatically kind of contained by mm-hmm. other genes that are kind of helping to regulate that, right? So by looking at pathways, you can see that there's, it's a convergence of several genes, so it's more likely to have an actual biological impact.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a follow-up to that. We wanted to look at, you know, we did see that there was significant genetic differential expression of genes in some pathways that were really interesting, including some stress pathways that were related to, you know, we see that clinically in both psychosis and in substance use disorder, there's an increased response to stress. And then some other pathways as well that were more kind of generic for plasticity and dopamine signaling. So we wanted to know mechanistically what might be, what epigenetic mechanism might be impacting this differential expression. So for this paper, we looked at DNA methylation, which is one of several ways that an epigenetic marker can influence your genetic expression. We chose DNA methylation because it's the most well-studied of the epigenetic mechanisms. So if you're going to find an effect, you're going to find it with DNA methylation. So what we did was we took those same three brain regions, nucleus accumbens shell, the infralimbic cortex, and the prelimbic cortex. And we didn't perform the analysis. We actually sent it off to collaborators of ours that are at Loma Linda University in California.
Okay.
So our collaborator there, Dr. Charles Wang, is the director of the genetic center there. So we, you know, collected tissue samples, we sent them off to them, and they processed those for us. So what we got back from them was this really complex data set that it was really interesting, and it's something that the lab, you know, I've since left, but the lab is still kind of going through what is the implication of these different pathways that we found that were affected. And differentially affected depending on what brain region we were looking at. But some of the key takeaways for us were a lot of enrichment in some of these pathways that are related to, again, plasticity. And this is something that is disrupted. We know it's disrupted in schizophrenia, and we know is impacted in substance use,
mm-hmm.
as well as, you know, we found increases in things like pathways that are related to amphetamine addiction, cocaine addiction, nicotine addiction. For us, that was really exciting because, you know, primarily what we study in the lab is nicotine, but we talk about it being the model being a drug abuse vulnerability model, not just nicotine. So this for us was validation that the model that we created is sensitive to all D2 agonists, or at least it seems to be. And it's not the effects that we're seeing with our conditioned place preference and with previous work we've done with sensitization. It's not specific to nicotine. It's not something that's specifically, you know, related to that mechanism of action that's specific to nicotine. It's something that is more general to D2 agonists.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was kind of really exciting for us was the results that we found overlapped a lot with a human study that was done, I think, 2017. So they took a lot of these genes that are associated with schizophrenia and associated with nicotine addiction. They looked at these, you know, do they group, what pathways do they group into? They use the same software to group these genes that we know were associated into pathways. And they found 52 shared genes between schizophrenia and nicotine addiction that converged on 12 different biological pathways, a lot of which overlapped with what we found. So like I mentioned, one of the primary goals of my dissertation research was looking at validating this model. So for us, that was really validating, but it was these biological markers that we're finding in our model are reflected in the clinical population.
Got it. And I think that covers all of the results in this particular study, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe to touch back on the MGLU5 sort of question. So we tested it in behavioral, which I don't think we mentioned. So behaviorally, what we found was if we administered CDPB, either a low dose or a high dose, prior to the nicotine administration, during conditioned place preference, we were actually able to block that enhanced conditioned place preference. It actually reduced their place preference back to like normal levels.
Okay.
Actually, it completely blocked. Yeah, sorry. So there were some dose-dependent effects. So with the high dose of CDPB, what we found was it completely blocked conditioned place preference, meaning they didn't show any preference for that side that was paired with nicotine. And then we found that the low dose it was partially effective. So it reduced it below the levels that we found when they were nicotine treated alone, but it wasn't enough that it brought it down to the level of, you know, completely blocking it. It didn't completely block it, but it did kind of partially alleviate it.
Got it. Okay. So just as a conclusion, in a few words, what do you think is the main contribution of this particular study in the big field of schizophrenia research?
Well, I think the easiest thing to point to is the drug studies, the MGLU5 work. So there are some clinical trials that are looking at the MGLU5 receptor for schizophrenia, and then some work that's looking at MGLU5 modulation for treating or drug abuse. But I think the interesting thing for us was that these studies that are out there prior to what we've done, it doesn't look at a system that's impacted by both of these things. So for us, you know, if you're looking at the literature, it's either they're looking at it in schizophrenia or they're looking at it in drug abuse. So we kind of put those two things together to see, you know, is it still effective for that drug abuse in a system that is disordered, in a system that has that D2 supersensitivity? Because drugs that are impacting these GPCRs, if the system is perturbed, it might not have the same impact as it would if you were administering it to a normal system. So I think that what we've shown in this paper and in previous work is that it's exactly what we see, is that MGLU5 positive allosteric modulation can have a different impact on a system that has D2 supersensitivity as it does in a normal system. And you can look through this paper, as well as another paper that we published on MGLU5, looking at some more plasticity markers. But yeah, I think what we've shown kind of as our whole body of work from the lab is that modulating this D2 receptor indirectly using an MGLU5 positive allosteric modulator, or in our previous work looking at CGS, which is a A2A receptor agonist, that we are able to reduce some of these phenotypes that are associated with psychosis and comorbid drug abuse. So condition place preference being one of them. The other behavioral test that we frequently do is called prepulse inhibition. It's just a test that is commonly used to screen antipsychotic medications. So very clinically relevant. It's also something that it's a test that you can do in humans.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the rare behavioral tests that we have that is translationally relevant, you can see what it looks like in a human, compare it to what it looks like in your model to give you kind of some validity. And it's also very good for screening these drugs that we think might have some antipsychotic potential. So you can look back at some of those papers as well if you're interested. But I think that's the biggest takeaway, is that this indirect modulation can have an effect on both the psychosis symptoms and on that comorbid nicotine abuse, which was really exciting for us.
Amazing. Well, I always say this, I am a science student, so I'm learning science along with my audience. And Lauren, thank you so much for coming here today and telling us about your science and telling us about the relationships between substance use disorder and psychosis.
Of course. Thanks for being interested.
All right. Thank you. And as always, I'll add a PubMed link to this particular paper so that you can look at it in more detail. I'll also add a link to the lab webpage of Dr. Russell Brown at East Tennessee State University. I say it correctly this time. Thank you for chiming in, and I'll come back with another paper next week. Until next week, ciao.